welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles. Yes, we're in the middle of summer. Yes, the heat can be stultifying. But maybe this is the moment to bring you a show with new titles on thinkers, entrepreneurs, and innovators. To quote Steve Jobs, the subject of one of today's books, "I'm convinced that about half of what separates the successful entrepreneurs from the non-successful ones is pure perseverance." Today's show spotlights those innovators who persevered, and in doing so, changed the world. My guest, Senator Gary Hart, is just out with a fascinating new book. He outlines critical changes we'll need to employ to get our government working again. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the book report. Elon Musk by Ashley Vance is an illuminating look at the extraordinary life of one of Silicon Valley's most exciting, unpredictable, and ambitious entrepreneurs. Musk, the renowned innovator behind SpaceX, Tesla, and SolarCity, has had amazing successes. He sold one of his internet companies, PayPal, for $1.5 billion. The book captures the full arc of Musk's life and work, from his tumultuous upbringing in South Africa, his flight to the U.S., his dramatic technical innovations, and entrepreneurial pursuits. Vance argues that Musk, one of the most unusual and striking figures in business history, is a visionary amalgam of legendary inventors and industrialists, including Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Howard Hughes, and Steve Jobs. Fred Sanders performs the book.
This question came from Elon Musk near the very end of a long dinner we shared at a high-end seafood restaurant in Silicon Valley. I'd gotten to the restaurant first and settled down with a gin and tonic, knowing Musk would, as ever, be late. After about 15 minutes, Musk showed up wearing leather shoes, designer jeans, and a plaid dress shirt. Musk stands 6'1". But ask anyone who knows him, and they'll confirm that he seems much bigger than that. He's absurdly broad-shouldered, sturdy, and thick. You'd figure he would use this frame to his advantage and perform an alpha male strut when entering a room. Instead, he tends to be almost sheepish. It's head tilted slightly down while walking, a quick handshake hello after reaching the table, and then butt in seat. From there, Musk needs a few minutes before he warms up and looks at ease. Musk asked me to dinner for a negotiation of sorts. 18 months earlier, I'd informed him of my plans to write a book about him, and he'd informed me of his plans not to cooperate. His rejection stung, but thrust me into dogged reporter mode. If I had to do this book without him, so be it. Plenty of people had left Musk's companies, Tesla Motors and SpaceX, and would talk. And I already knew a lot of his friends. The interviews followed one after another, month after month, and 200 or so people into the process, I heard from Musk once again. He called me at home and declared that things could go one of two ways. He could make my life very difficult, or he could help with the project after all. He'd be willing to cooperate if he could read the book before it went to publication and could add footnotes throughout it. He would not meddle with my text, but he wanted the chance to set the record straight in spots that he deemed factually inaccurate. I understood where this was coming from. Musk wanted a measure of control over his life story. He's also wired like a scientist and suffers mental anguish at the sight of a factual error. A mistake on a printed page would gnaw at his soul forever. While I could understand his perspective, I could not let him read the book for professional, personal, and practical reasons. Musk has his version of the truth, and it's not always the version of the truth that the rest of the world shares. He's prone to verbose answers to even the simplest of questions as well, and the thought of 30-page footnotes seemed all too real. Still, we agreed to have dinner, chat all this out, and see where it left us. Our conversation began with a discussion of public relations people. Musk burns through PR staffers notoriously fast, and Tesla was in the process of hunting for a new communications chief. "Who is the best PR person in the world?" he asked in a very Muskian fashion. Then we talked about mutual acquaintances, Howard Hughes, and the Tesla factory. When the waiter stopped by to take our order, Musk asked for suggestions that would work with his low-carb diet. He settled on chunks of fried lobster soaked in black squid ink. The negotiation hadn't begun, and Musk was already dishing. He opened up about the major fear keeping him up at night, namely that Google's co-founder and CEO, Larry Page, might well have been building a fleet of artificial intelligence-enhanced robots capable of destroying mankind. "I'm really worried about this," Musk said. It didn't make Musk feel any better that he and Page were very close friends, and that he felt Page was fundamentally a well-intentioned person and not Dr. Evil. In fact, that was sort of the problem. Page's nice guy nature left him assuming that the machines would forever do our bidding. "I'm not as optimistic," Musk said. "He could produce something evil by accident." As the food arrived, Musk consumed it. That is, he didn't eat it as much as he made it disappear rapidly with a few gargantuan bites. Desperate to keep Musk happy and chatting, I handed him a big chunk of steak from my plate. The plan worked. For all of 90 seconds. Meat. Hunk. Gone.
We've just heard Elon Musk by Ashley Vance. Gary Hart served as a senator from Colorado from 1975 to 1987. After leaving Congress, he resumed his private law practice and, in 2001, earned a doctorate in political theory from Oxford University. He served as an advisor to American companies on large-scale international projects, taught courses at Yale Law School and the University of Colorado, and chaired a number of U.S. government commissions. Senator Hart has written several books on U.S. history and politics. Today we'll speak with him about his newest title, The Republic of Conscience. Welcome, Senator. It's an honor to have you with us on the Book Report.
It's my pleasure, and thank you.
You describe yourself as a constitutional evangelist. How so?
I'm one of those kids that went to public school and took eighth grade civics and took it seriously. And I guess I've taken it seriously ever since and responded to the Kennedy challenge in the 60s to participate in government and participate in the public life of our country. And just can't get over it.
In The Republic of Conscience, you spotlight campaign finance, how congressmen sell their souls to special interests to get elected, then work to get reelected. How can we break out of this destructive cycle?
Well, I think it'd be helpful if former members of Congress, first of all, didn't walk out the door and become lobbyists themselves. That did not happen on any significant scale when I was in office in the 70s and 80s. Since that time, it's become quite acceptable, if not fashionable, for members of the House and Senate to stay in Washington and join lobbying firms or law firms that, in effect, lobby. I think I've heard reports there are over 400 former members of Congress who are now out lobbying in some way. And I just think that this did not happen when I was in the Senate in those days, and it's happened in the last 25 or 30 years. So I would hope we would restore a time when people voluntarily would practice law in the traditional sense and not convert a title given them by their constituents into income.
Do you think it's possible to reach a place where candidates are not elected based on the size of their TV budget?
Well, it happens. It does happen, and I had experience with that years ago. There are times when the candidate with the least money does win because that individual man or woman has a better story to tell and more ideas for solving our problems. But overwhelmingly, we get elected by being on the media, paid media, and that costs a lot of money. Most of the campaign dollars that are raised, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, and now in the presidential campaign, billions, much of that money goes to paid media, television and radio, and people respond to it.
You wrote in the book, we have a sinister system combining staggering campaign costs, political contributions, political action committees, special interest payments for access, and most of all, the rise of the lobbying class. Is there hope for our political system?
Oh, of course. And the history of our country, we've had political scandals before, Teapot Dome and real bribery in the past of individuals or small groups. I don't think we've ever had what I would call legal corruption, using the founders of our nation, their definition of corruption, which was placing special interests ahead of the common good. It's the legalization of that kind of corruption that's a danger to our country, and that's really a happening of the last two or three decades, I would say 25 or 30 years.
You write about the clash of court and country. Can you explain?
Well, our founders came here, obviously, from Europe, and many of them from England, and in the late 17th and early 18th century, England began to divide between what was called the court and the country. And the country was composed of everyday farmers and shopkeepers and ordinary citizens. The court, obviously, was the power structure. That was the king of the day, the courtiers, the people surrounding the king, people of privilege and prerogative and power. And the countryside understood that they were shut out of government and no one paid attention to them. And what I warned against, and the founders warned against, was that kind of polarization occurring in this country, that everyday people across the country, Denver, Colorado, and elsewhere, believing that the government has become such a closed system, and if you're not in that power structure and intricate networks and Rolodexes, then you just have no voice at all or no power at all. That, as I said, is a very dangerous situation. We can get out of it, but it's going to require an alarmed citizenry that demands change.
We're speaking with Senator Gary Hart on the Book Report. Many believe that the Supreme Court put the U.S. government for sale to the highest bidder. What are your thoughts?
Well, as I say in the book, it's the Citizen United decision, as a lawyer, Citizen United decision dumbfounded me, as it did many, many others, including legal professionals. For a Supreme Court justice who is supposed to understand our Constitution and its history to conclude that a corporation, which is a legal fiction, has the same right of speech as an everyday American and can put unlimited amounts of money into promoting its own special interests, is to legalize this corruption that the founders warned us against. How they could reach that decision is staggering to me. It is so wrong, and it must be ultimately reversed, which means the court has to change, and it's going to be several years.
Right. What is your vision of a global commons, which you wrote about in the book?
I think it's happening with globalization, with the age of information, with the dramatic increase in trade, including American trade. We're selling advanced aircraft all around the world, civilian aircraft. We're selling Microsoft software. We're selling high technology, medical technologies. So trade is trade's a two-way street, and we have to compete in it. And we're also leading the world in information technologies, which are transforming governments and transforming political systems all over the place. What we have to resist is thinking that our power is only in our military. We have enormous economic power, and we have even more power in our political principles to the degree we live up to them. I've traveled the world enough to know that people around the world see the difference between who we say we are and how we actually behave. We go to war to bring supposedly to bring democracy to the Iraqis, and yet I can guarantee you there are an awful lot of people in Iraq who know that 50% of the American people don't take the trouble to vote.
How do you think history will judge the Obama presidency?
Too early to say. It will take a long time. He inherited, it's fashionable to say, he inherited a mess, which he did. and it took us six or seven years to begin to dig out of the economic collapse of 08, which he walked right into. And then he had to liquidate two wars. So he didn't come into an ordinary presidency or White House. He came in with two strikes against him. Since that time, there are mixed opinions about Obamacare, but it's here to stay. I think it's a major achievement in getting health care to millions of people who didn't have it at an affordable cost. And the picture internationally is mixed. He's struggling to get trade agreements in the Pacific, which are very important to American companies, and American workers, for that matter, who are exporting. And the list goes on. Our education system isn't nearly what it should be. We need to make real progress in that area. So it's a mixed picture, and it's going to take, as usual, 10, 15, 25 years.
Hmm. What is your opinion about the crop of 2016 presidential hopefuls?
A lot of them on the Republican side. What's distressing are the number of them, those least well-known, not as known as Governor Bush, who are seeking the support of billionaires, and billionaires holding their own primaries to summon candidates to appear before them as if they were potentates, to recite their litany of whether they agree or disagree with the billionaires' list of desires, where the Koch brothers or casino operators or car salesmen or whoever has all that money. That's a very dangerous thing as well. There are not enough candidates on the Democratic side. I believe Governor O'Malley deserves to be heard. I think Senator Webb from Virginia, who has just entered, deserves to be heard. And there may be other candidates as well.
I couldn't agree more. Are you already at work on a new book?
Not while I'm trying to get people to pay attention to this book. But I do like to write, and I've written a lot, and I'll probably find a new project.
All right. Well, Senator, the Republic of Conscience was insightful and very accessible. Senator, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my great pleasure, and thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Senator. Thank you.
Bye.
While building the Virgin Group for over 40 years, Richard Branson has never shied away from outlandish challenges others considered sheer lunacy. He took on giants like British Airways and won, and monsters like Coca-Cola and lost. Now, in the Virgin way, Branson illuminates his strikingly different swashbuckling style. Fun, family, passion, and the dying art of listening are key components of his philosophy. This unique perspective comes from a man who dropped out of school at 16, suffers from dyslexia, and has never worked for anyone but himself. He may be famous for thinking outside the box, but Branson asserts that you'll never have to think outside the box if you refuse to let anyone build one around you. Gildart Jackson narrates.
As fallible human beings, we all make our share of mistakes and get ourselves into the kind of predicaments that result from making the wrong choices. But in the vast majority of such situations, we all have the ability to pause, take stock, and say, "Sorry, but I'm really not happy with this, so I'm out of here." I recognize that in a lot of instances, particularly when friends and family are involved, this may be easier said than done, and taking any such drastic action usually calls for a lot of courage. However, as the old adage goes, when you make mistakes, at least try to make them quickly. I have often had people say to me, "Well, sure, Richard, all that stuff is easy for you to say when you've built your business and you've pretty much made it in life." To this, my response is always along the lines of, "Yes, that's true, to a degree. But why do you think I have all those companies? They almost certainly wouldn't be there had I not repeatedly dug my heels in and refused to spend my time on things I recognized as just not right for me." One of the earliest examples of a situation in which I felt off-kilter was my time at school. When I shocked my parents as well as friends by dropping out of the prestigious Stowe School at age 16, I did it with my young eyes wide open in order to pursue a dream of starting my own magazine publishing business. In my heart of hearts, I knew that making Student Magazine a success simply didn't necessitate me spending any more of my precious time sitting in stuffy classrooms. The idea of spending another couple of years memorizing mind-numbing facts from textbooks, wrestling with the joys of calculus and defining little-known Latin verbs, seemed totally irrelevant to my future life, and so I had to escape or risk losing my sanity. Please don't misinterpret this as some kind of burn-your-books, anti-education tirade. Quite the opposite. Availing yourself of the best education you can get is an imperative, particularly in today's ultra-competitive commercial world. When I went to school, however, learning was much more of a memorization and regurgitation process than it seems to be today. The old way was particularly challenging for someone like me with dyslexia and borderline ADD, attention deficit disorder. There were several excellent teachers who did make their subjects come to life, but with my early stage entrepreneurial juices starting to flow, I had mentally moved on already. The paradoxical twist is that ever since I dropped out of school, I have spent the balance of my life with a thirst for learning about new things, businesses, people, and cultures. The big difference, of course, is that my learning process has involved experiencing all these things firsthand, as opposed to reading about them in books or thirdhand from someone who frequently had never lived outside of academia. Although I had serious trouble tuning in to teachers in school, when I struck out on my own, I had to quickly set about honing my dubious listening skills. One of the first of many tasks I took on at student was that of cub reporter, so when interviewing someone, I had no option but to listen intently while scribbling down notes that sometimes were almost completely indecipherable. Whether it was with John Lennon or John Le Carré, I had to rapidly acquire the art of simultaneously listening, writing, and thinking about my next follow-on question. It was somewhat of a Chinese plate trick, as you had to keep all the components spinning, or you found yourself helplessly adrift. But the ability to lock in and listen is a skill that has served me well in life. Although it seems to be somewhat of a dying art, I believe that listening is one of the most important skills for any teacher, parent, leader, entrepreneur, or, well, just about anyone who has a pulse. What's become known around our various companies as the Virgin Way is something that has evolved since day one.
That was The Virgin Way by Richard Branson. Becoming Steve Jobs by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli breaks down the myth about the man. It answers the central question about Jobs' life and career. How did a young man so reckless and so arrogant that he was exiled from the company he founded become the most visionary business leader of our time, ultimately transforming the daily lives of billions of people? Drawing on exclusive access, the authors tell the story of a real man who wrestled with his failings and learned to maximize his strengths. The compelling narrative is filled with stories from family, former Inner Circle executives, and top people at Apple, Pixar, and Disney. In addition, Schlender, one of the authors, knew Jobs personally for 25 years and drew on many interviews with him, on and off the record. George Newbern narrates.
The details of his new startup had been kept hush-hush. In part because Apple had filed lawsuits trying to prevent Jobs from hiring away its employees. But Apple had finally dropped those suits. And now, according to the publicist from Jobs' PR agency, who called my boss at the Journal, Steve was willing to do a handful of interviews with major business publications. He was ready to start the public fan dance that would begin to reveal in detail what exactly Next was up to. I was thoroughly fascinated and equally wary. I didn't want to get taken in by the notoriously charismatic Mr. Jobs. The drive south to Palo Alto is a trip through the history of Silicon Valley. From Route 92 in San Mateo over to Interstate 280, a bucolic eight-laner skirting San Andreas Lake and Crystal Springs Reservoir, which store drinking water for San Francisco, piped in from the Sierras. Past the blandly ostentatious venture capitalist habitat along Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, and traversing the oblique, mile-long Stanford Linear Accelerator, which slashes like a hairline fracture through the landscape and beneath the freeway. Past the Stanford Dish Radio Telescope, and the white-faced Herefords and ornate oak trees dotting the expansive greenbelt behind the university campus. The winter and spring rains had resurrected the prairie grass on the hills, turning them briefly as green as a golf course from their usual dull yellow, and peppering them with patches of orange, purple, and yellow wildflowers. I was so new to the Bay Area that I didn't yet realize that this was the most beautiful time of year to make this drive. My exit, Page Mill Road, was the home street address of Hewlett-Packard, early biotech pioneer Alza Corporation, Silicon Valley facilitators like Anderson Consulting, now called Accenture, and the law firm Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rosati. But first you hit the university-owned Stanford Research Park, with its groves of low-slung corporate research and development labs, situated with lots of grassy elbow room. Xerox's famed Palo Alto Research Center Park, where Steve first saw a computer with a mouse and a graphical bitmapped screen interface, resides here. This was where he had chosen to headquarter next. A young woman from Next's PR firm, Allison Thomas Associates, escorted me through the boxy two-story concrete and glass office building to a small conference room with a view of a half-filled parking lot and not much more. Steve was waiting there. He greeted me with a nod, dismissed the flack, and before I could get seated, popped that first question. I wasn't sure if Steve wanted a monosyllabic answer or if he was genuinely curious about who I was and where I came from. I assumed the latter, so I started ticking off the places and industries I'd written about for the journal. Right after leaving graduate school at the University of Kansas, I'd moved to Dallas for the paper, where I'd written about aviation, airlines, and electronics, since Texas Instruments and Radio Shack were based there. Along the way, I had won some notoriety for a profile of John Hinckley, the privileged son of a Texas oil man who shot President Reagan in 1981. "What year did you graduate from high school?" he interjected. 1972, I replied. "And I spent 7 years in college but never quite got my master's degree." "That's when I graduated from high school," he interjected. "So we're about the same age." I found out later that he had skipped a grade. I then explained that I'd spent 2 years each in Central America and Hong Kong writing and reporting on geopolitical issues for the journal, and a year in Los Angeles before finally wangling my dream job in San Francisco. At this point, it really was beginning to feel like a job interview, except that Jobs wasn't reacting much to any of my answers.
That was Becoming Steve Jobs by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli. Neither soldier nor orator, low on charisma and high on intelligence, James Madison cared more about achieving results than taking the credit. To reach his lifelong goal of a self-governing constitutional republic, he blended his talents with those of key partners. In Madison's Gift by David Steward, we see it was Madison who led the drive for the Constitutional Convention and pressed for an effective new government as his patron, George Washington, lent the effort legitimacy. Madison, who wrote the Federalist Papers with Alexander Hamilton to secure the Constitution's ratification. Madison, who corrected the greatest blunder of the Constitution by drafting and securing passage of the Bill of Rights. Madison, who joined Thomas Jefferson to found the nation's first political party and move the country toward broad democratic principles. Madison, who with James Monroe guided the new nation through its first war in 1812, really its second war of independence. It was his final partnership that allowed Madison to escape his natural shyness and reach the greatest heights. Dolly was the woman he married in middle age and who presided over both him and an enlivened White House. Grover Gardner narrates.
A former Army officer himself, Hamilton warned that some officers aimed to oust George Washington as commander and to remain in arms until they were paid. Congress made more promises to the soldiers, as did state officials, but they were empty ones. There was no money. It was a recipe for insurrection. An army with no enemy to fight and real grievances against its own government. Inflammatory letters circulated among the officers, urging an end to the waiting, lest they grow old in poverty, wretchedness, and contempt, one railed. The soldiers must change the milk and water style of their demands. In Congress, Madison urged the fractious states to agree on a national tax that would pay the nation's soldiers and its debts. Without such action, he predicted, a dissolution of the Union would be inevitable. The southern states would go one way, New England another, the middle states a third, each seeking alliances with European powers. Congress appointed Madison to a committee charged with developing a fiscal solution. While Congress dithered, one man prevented mutiny. General Washington called an assembly of officers for March 15th, the Ides of March. For those who knew their Shakespeare, it must have seemed a portentous date. Standing before his brother officers, Washington recalled sacrifices shared through battle and privation, misery and loss. This was not the time, he said, to open the floodgates of civil discord and deluge our rising empire in blood. It was not his prepared statement, but a theatrical aside that carried the day. When he began to read a letter aloud, Washington stumbled over the words, then donned a pair of spectacles. "Gentlemen," he said, "you must pardon me. I have grown gray in your service and now find myself growing blind." Some wept. Most were ashamed. All were moved. The mutiny dissolved with a unanimous resolution supporting Washington. In the breathing space won by the general, Madison concocted a plan. It was a political hodgepodge. He proposed a 25-year import tax that was set too low to pay off the debt, so he wishfully assumed that states would continue to contribute money to the national government, plus additional revenues from the sale of western lands. In a closing exhortation, Madison argued that through this plan, the cause of liberty will acquire a dignity and luster which it has never yet enjoyed. Continued drift, he warned, would mean the failure of the last and fairest experiment in favor of the rights of human nature. 6 weeks later, Washington echoed Madison's appeal in his own circular letter of farewell to the army. The state's actions on the national tax would determine, he wrote, whether the revolution must ultimately be considered a blessing or a curse, not to the present age alone, for with our fate will the destiny of unborn millions be involved. Neither appeal worked. Virginia, home to both Madison and Washington, refused to adopt the plan, killing it outright. Worse was coming. Within days of Washington's circular, disgruntled Pennsylvania soldiers surrounded Philadelphia's State House, where Congress was sitting, and demanded their back pay. When Pennsylvania's governor refused to call out his state's militia to oppose the mutineers, the congressional delegates fled, resolving to reconvene in tiny Princeton, New Jersey. Although Madison had spent three happy years in Princeton as a student, he despised it as the nation's temporary capital. The room he shared with another Virginian measured not more than 10 square feet. For one roommate to dress, the other had to remain in the single bed. The only position available for writing scarcely admits the use of any of my limbs. Madison was depressed by the spectacle of Congress cowering in a remote village to escape its own soldiers. On top of the rejection by Kitty Floyd, his world was turning bleak. For the first time in his career, Madison began to play hooky. He missed more than half of the congressional sessions between June 30th and early November when his term expired.
We've just heard Madison's Gift by David Stewart. In Strategy, A History, Sir Lawrence Friedman, one of the world's leading authorities on war and international politics, captures the vast history of strategic thinking. The range of Friedman's narrative moves from the surprisingly advanced strategy practiced in primate groups to the opposing strategies of Achilles and Odysseus in the Iliad, the strategic advice of Sun Tzu and Machiavelli, the revolutionary strategy in class struggles by Marx, and the insights into corporate strategy from Peter Drucker and Alfred Sloan. The core issue at the heart of strategy is whether it is possible to manipulate and shape our environment rather than simply become the victim of forces beyond one's control. Michael Butler Murray performs the book.
Man is descended from a hairy-tailed quadruped, probably arboreal in its habits. Charles Darwin. In this chapter, I argue that there are elemental features of human strategy that are common across time and space. These include deception and coalition formation, and the instrumental use of violence. These features are so elemental that traces of them can be found among chimpanzees. Chimps are self-aware, understand others well enough to deceive them, and show gratitude or retribution according to whether they have been given or denied support. They have forms of communication, think through difficult problems, and plan ahead. Years of careful observation of chimpanzees, first in the wild and then in special colonies at zoos, challenged the previous view that their social bonds were limited. It became apparent that individual chimps in the same area came together regularly and developed complex relations. They not only worked together, but also had fights. Of particular interest for students of strategy, chimpanzees were political in their behavior. They built up coalitions, offering grooming, sex, and food to potential supporters, all in order to prevail in conflicts. But they also appreciated the importance of limiting their conflicts so that they could live cooperatively thereafter. They kissed and made up after a violent quarrel. By showing their vulnerability, they invited trust. During the 1970s, Franz de Waal observed the chimpanzee colony at Arnhem Zoo, making copious notes as a remarkable series of dramas began to unfold. In his 1982 book, Chimpanzee Politics, he drew some startling conclusions about the complexity of chimpanzee society. In his view, the evidence of coalition formation and power struggles among the chimps deserved the label political. Raw strength could only take chimps so far. When dominant males asserted power, their hair stood on end to make them appear larger and more ferocious than they actually were. They charged at groups of subordinate apes, who immediately scattered, and then received due respect through some submissive greeting or by being groomed in an elaborate fashion. De Waal realized, however, that as the hierarchy changed, those gaining power were not necessarily the stronger. Social maneuvers were of even greater importance as other chimpanzees joined in on one side or the other and shifted their allegiances. Changes in the hierarchy were not abrupt, but orderly. The first change, charted by De Waal, began with an established dominant male, Yeroen, initially enjoying the support of most of the females, but appearing unsure of how to respond to a conspicuous challenge to his authority by another male, Lout. In a definite affront, Lout mated with a female right in front of Yeroen. Then Lout got another male, Nikki, to join him to tilt the balance of power in his favor. During the course of the power struggles, the tactics deployed involved not only displays of strength and determination, but also measures designed to encourage females to defect, such as grooming them and playing with their children. Yeroen's angry tantrums, which might once have made subordinates wary of his defecting, gradually lost their impact as they became more frequent. He eventually gave up. This struggle led to another, With Lout now dominant, Yeroen was prepared to work with Nicky to regain some of his past prestige, even though he would not become dominant again. Actual fighting played only a small part in the process. Biting, the most dangerous act of aggression, was rarely used. DeWall concluded that rather than changing the social relationships, the fights tended to reflect the changes that had already taken place. The apes appeared to know that they should limit violence among themselves, for they might have to unite against external rivals. They also seemed to understand the need for mediation and reconciliation. Once a goal had been achieved, the patterns of behavior changed. For example, both the winners and losers became less aggressive.
We've heard a sampling of Strategy, a History by Lawrence Friedman. Napoleon's battles are among the greatest in history, but he was far more than a military genius and an astute leader of men. Like George Washington and his own hero, Julius Caesar, Napoleon was one of the greatest soldier statesmen of all times. Andrew Roberts' Napoleon, A Life, is the first one-volume biography to take advantage of the recent publication of Napoleon's 33,000 letters, which radically transform our understanding of his character and motivation. Like Churchill, he understood the strategic importance of telling his own story, and his memoirs, dictated from exile on St. Helena, became the single best-selling book of the 19th century. Roberts traveled to 53 of Napoleon's 60 battle sites, discovered crucial new documents in archives, and even made the long trip by boat to St. Helena. John Lee performs the book.
He could entirely close off one part of his mind to what was going on in the rest of it. He himself likened it to being able to open and close drawers in a cupboard. On the eve of battle, as aides-de-camp were arriving and departing with orders to his marshals and reports from his generals, he could dictate his thoughts on the establishment of a girls' school for the orphans of members of the Légion d'honneur. And shortly after having captured Moscow, he set down the regulations governing the Comédie Française. No detail about his empire was too minute for his restless, questing energy. The prefect of a department would be instructed to stop taking his young mistress to the opera. An obscure country priest would be reprimanded for giving a bad sermon on his birthday. A corporal told he was drinking too much. A demi-brigade that it could stitch the words Les Incomparables in gold onto its standard. He was one of the most unrelenting micromanagers in history, but this obsession with details did not prevent him from radically transforming the physical, legal, political, and cultural landscape of Europe. More books have been written with Napoleon in the title than there have been days since his death in 1821. Admittedly, many have titles like Napoleon's Hemorrhoids and Napoleon's Buttons, but there are several thousand comprehensive, cradle-to-grave biographies, too. Every one of them, published since 1857, relied upon the correspondence that Napoleon III published as a tribute to his uncle. We now know that this was shamefully bowdlerized and distorted for propaganda purposes. Letters that Napoleon never wrote were included, while embarrassing or compromising ones that he did write were passed over. In all, the compendium included only two-thirds of his total output. In one of the great publishing endeavors of the 21st century, the Fondation Napoleon in Paris has, since 2004, been publishing every one of the more than 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed. The culmination of this immense project demands nothing less than a complete re-evaluation of this extraordinary man. Napoleon represented the Enlightenment on horseback. His letters show a charm, humor, and capacity for candid self-appraisal. He could lose his temper, volcanically so on occasion, but usually with some cause. Above all, he was no totalitarian dictator, as many have been eager to suggest. He may have established an unprecedentedly efficient surveillance system, but he had no interest in controlling every aspect of his subjects' lives, nor did he want the lands he conquered to be ruled directly by Frenchmen. He believed that one can control foreign lands only by winning over the population, and sought accordingly to present himself in terms that would make him sympathetic to the locals, feigning sympathy for their religion as a means to an end. It is notable that his strategies varied considerably in Italy, Egypt, and Germany. In the one instance where this was not the case, Haiti, he later acknowledged that the brutality of his policies had compromised his effectiveness, and mused with foresight that one could not keep people subject for long at a great distance. Above all, he hoped to modernize Europe. "They seek to destroy the revolution by attacking my person," he said after the failure of the royalist assassination plot of 1804. "I will defend it, for I am the revolution." His characteristic egotism aside, Napoleon was right. He personified the best parts of the French Revolution, the ones that have survived and infused European life ever since. Although the Terror had finished 5 years before he grabbed power, the Jacobins were a powerful force who could always return. Similarly, a royalist restoration which would have wiped away the benefits of the revolution was also possible. Instead, the 15-year rule of Napoleon saved the best aspects of the revolution, discarded the worst, and ensured that even when the Bourbons were restored, they could not return to the Ancien Régime. The ideas that underpin our modern world – meritocracy, equality before the law, property rights, religious toleration, modern secular education, sound finances, and so on – were championed, consolidated, codified, and geographically extended by Napoleon. To them he added rational and efficient local administration, an end to rural banditry, the encouragement of science and the arts, the abolition of feudalism, and the greatest codification of laws since the fall of the Roman Empire. At the same time, he dispensed with the absurd revolutionary calendar of 10-day weeks, the theology of the cult of the supreme being, the corruption and cronyism of the directory, and the hyperinflation that had characterized the dying days of the Republic.
That was a sampling of Napoleon, A Life, by Andrew Roberts. In September 2014, a Chinese company that most Americans never heard of held the largest IPO in history, bigger than Google, Facebook, and Twitter combined. Alibaba, now the world's largest e-commerce company, seems to have escaped Western notice for over 10 years while building a customer base larger than Amazon's and handling the bulk of e-commerce transactions in China. How did this happen? In Alibaba's world, author Porter Arisman, one of Alibaba's first Western employees and its head of international marketing from 2000 to 2008, shows how Jack Ma, a Chinese schoolteacher who twice failed his college entrance exams, rose from obscurity to found Alibaba and lead it from struggling startup to the world's most dominant e-commerce player. He shares stories of weathering the dot-com crash, facing down eBay and Google, negotiating with the unpredictable Chinese government, and he analyzes Alibaba's role as a harbinger of the new global business landscape, with its focus on the East rather than the West, emerging markets over developed ones, and the nimble entrepreneur over the industry titan. George Newbern performs the book.
During the previous 5 years, those of us working in China could only watch with envy as friends and former classmates took part in the thrilling U.S. internet boom. As companies like Yahoo, Amazon, and eBay became listed on NASDAQ, wave after wave of internet mania spread throughout Europe and the United States, minting thousands of fresh millionaires with each new IPO. But with less than 1% of the country's population online, China's internet industry seemed destined to languish for decades. Everything changed in the summer of 1999 with the IPO of China.com, a Hong Kong-based consumer internet portal that styled itself as the Yahoo of China. Never mind that it was a hollow company with no real business model. China.com had a great domain name and appeal to investors chasing China's 2.6 billion eyeballs, just as Netscape's IPO had triggered the internet gold rush in the United States. China.com's IPO sent investors rushing to China. And for those of us patiently waiting for the internet mania to arrive, it was a welcome stampede. At the time, I was working as the head of a technology group at Ogilvy & Mather in Beijing, managing PR and marketing campaigns for foreign companies entering the China market. When I first took the role at Ogilvy, I had assumed that I'd be helping grow the business of multinational companies like Nokia, our largest tech client at the time. But as the internet boom took hold, My client list quickly grew to include an increasing number of foreign internet companies that showed an interest in China. Not long after the U.S. companies started entering the China market, homegrown startups emerged, modeling themselves after their U.S. counterparts. Within a year, the number of internet clients in my group had grown from 1 to 10. I watched these clients not only having a lot of fun, but discovering the possibility of changing the world along the way. I was beginning to think it was time to join a startup myself. Little did I know, while I was toiling away in Beijing, that Jack Ma and a team of his friends were secretly working day and night in a small apartment in Hangzhou, 2 hours south of Shanghai. While other companies in China were chasing consumers, creating Chinese clones of the hottest U.S. properties, Jack and his team set out to capture businesses. Their vision was to build a marketplace connecting the world's small and medium-sized businesses engaged in global trade. The widget economy, made up of manufacturers, trading companies, and wholesalers comprising the global supply chain. And their website, Alibaba.com, was meant to allow these small businesses access to the riches that only the internet could unlock. In October 1999, Alibaba finally came out of hiding and was officially launched at a press conference in Hong Kong, where Jack also announced a $5 million round of investment in Alibaba led by Goldman Sachs. Word began to spread as news stories trickled out about a little-known school teacher who was trying to build a platform for global trade. In January 2000, Jack and his team raised another $20 million, led by Japan's SoftBank. And by March, in preparation for the company's global expansion, Alibaba began to hire a professional international management team. At about this time, I started looking for a startup to join. But my hunt for the next big thing got off to a slow start. I started with an interview with a leading internet portal. I met with the vice president of marketing, a transplant from Hong Kong who was hiring a corporate communications manager in preparation for a possible IPO. I think it would be exciting to work with the team to help craft the vision for you and the company as it moves forward, I told my would-be boss. Let's be clear here. I'll set the vision and you execute it, he coldly replied. With that, I scratched them off the list. I was looking to join a team, not a dictatorship. I next interviewed with an online stock trading company that billed itself as the E-Trade of China. But when I met with a husband and wife team who had founded the company, something didn't smell right. Their company headquarters was a virtual office, and the sources of their investment seemed suspect. By the end of the interview, I was convinced all they wanted was a Western face for their company as they pursued activities of questionable legality.
That was Alibaba's World by Porter Arisman. Readers, I hope you found a title or two worthy of your summer reading list. Brave and bold, these men, to quote Mark Twain, threw off the bow lines, sailed away from safe harbor, caught the trade winds in their sails, and explored, dreamt, discovered. They clearly understood, do or not do, there is no try. Thank you, Yoda, Jedi Master. For more titles in every genre, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.